Thank you. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marcia Hashemi, signing up for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pafizkar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Vietnam's Iran's top nuclear negotiator tells Press TV that the process of the removal of sanctions is highly complicated and requires more negotiations. The doctor who performed the autopsy on African-American George Floyd last year testifies that his death at the hands of the US police was homicide. Also in the headlines, protesters in the Algerian capital, Algiers, who were demanding political change, slammed France for supporting President Tebboune. Good to have you with us. Now, the latest meeting of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action's Joint Commission in Vienna appears to have ended without a breakthrough. Iran's top nuclear negotiator says the negotiations on reviving the 2015 nuclear deal should still continue after 3 days of intensive discussions, Abbas Araghchi said the process of the removal of sanctions is highly complicated and requires more negotiations. Araghchi stressed that his country must see the effects of the removal of U.S. sanctions in practice before it returns to compliance with the JCPOA.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA comes to an end in Vienna. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says Iran's demand is clear. It will only come back to full compliance with the agreement after the U.S. lifts sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA. And Iran will also want to verify the sanctions lifting.
What we mean by verification is to see the effects of sanctions lifting in practice. So it is not enough for the U.S. to sign, you know, waivers or, I don't know, executive orders, whatever. Yes, they have to officially sign, but what matters for us is to see the effect of sanction lifting on the ground.
China's representative said the sides are narrowing down their differences. He said Beijing believes all the nuclear-related unilateral U.S. sanctions are illegal and should be lifted immediately to safeguard the JCPOA. The demand to lift all sanctions at once is a legitimate one, he said.
We think it's legitimate for them to lift it all at once, and it's an important issue.
But will they do it? Have they agreed?
They have undertaken to do it, but we say that they must put it into action, turn their commitments into action.
Araghchi said he believes it is possible to get the job done sooner rather than later, but it depends on how willing and serious the other side is. After 3 days of intensive discussions within two working groups, the delegates agreed the talks are moving in the right direction. The Joint Commission will meet again on Wednesday amid hopes to maintain momentum. Homa Leski, Vienna.
Turning to other news, the Yemeni army says it has carried out a successful drone strike against targets at Saudi Arabia's Abha International Airport. The Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Saria said the strike, conducted by a Qassam 2K drone, was in response to Saudi Arabia's escalation of aggression and continued siege of Yemen. However, the Saudi-led coalition claims it intercepted and destroyed a Yemeni explosives-laden drone heading towards Khamis Mushayyad, a city east of Abha. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have been carrying out retaliatory attacks since then. They have vowed to continue the raids until Saudi Arabia stops its aggression. Dates are a staple of the Middle East and some other parts of Asia. For Muslims, they're the food of choice for breaking the fast during Ramadan, but Muslims living in the EU and Britain are being asked not to eat just any dates, and as Saeed Poreza reports, it all comes down to where they're coming from.
Dates, one of the fruits of paradise in Islamic tradition. With their paper-thin skin and juicy sweet flesh, they have pride of place, especially on Muslim dinner tables.
Walk into any halal shop or indeed any supermarket here in the UK and you're bound to see dates on display. They come from many different places, including from Palestinian territories. And during Ramadan, they simply fly off the shelf. But could the Muslims living here in Britain, by taking dates to break their fast during the holy month, be unknowingly supporting the brutal Israeli occupation of Palestinians?
We put that question to the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, an NGO running a campaign to boycott Israeli dates in the UK, now Israel's third target market.
They were breaking their fast on a date which is being grown on stolen land, which is actually even unlawful, to break your fast with something which is haram.
Israel is one of the world's top five exporters of dates. In 2018, the UK was Israel's largest market for dates worth more than $25 million. Over half of those are grown in illegal settlements, ruled by the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, and several other international organizations as illegal and built on stolen Palestinian land. Not only that, Israeli settlers are set to employ low-paid Palestinian laborers, among them children, to do the back-breaking job of picking the dates. But how are Muslims and non-Muslim Palestinian rights activists to ensure that the dates they're eating are not from the illegal Israeli settlements?
Israelis, instead of coming out and saying product of Israel, they are hiding the identity of the dates. Packages like this, you know, Al-Malik, you know, a Muslim name, Arabic writing, product of Palestine. But when you look, you realize it's a con, because there is no company importer or distributor attached to this.
This year's call to boycott Israeli dates subscribes to the mission of the Global Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressure Israel to comply with international law.
We were in Britain number one importer of Israeli dates. Last year we informed everyone that we have become second, and this year we have become third. And at the same time, Palestinian dates are being supported and imported more.
This Ramadan, when Muslims in Britain break their fast with dates, they'll be wise to ask themselves if the dates they're eating are helping ease the suffering of Palestinians, or are they going towards oppressing them? Saeed Puriza, London.
Turning elsewhere, the doctor who examined the body of George Floyd after his death last year confirms his death at the hands of the U.S. police was homicide.
So my opinion remains unchanged. It's what I put on the death certificate last June. That's cardiopulmonary arrest, complicating law enforcement, subdual restraint, and neck compression. I would still classify it as a homicide today.
Baker also rejected the defense team's allegations that the African-American died because of drug overdose plus an earlier heart condition. Baker is one of the most important witnesses as Minnesota prosecutors wrap up their case against Derek Chauvin. The white officer is charged with murdering George Floyd. He was captured on video, kneeling on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes before he stopped breathing. This happened in May 2020 and triggered over 3 months of nationwide unrest unseen in the U.S. for decades. A U.S. congressional ethics panel has launched an investigation into alleged misconduct by a Republican lawmaker. The probe comes following a flurry of accusations against Matt Gaetz, including allegations of sexual misconduct and illegal drug use. U.S. media say the representative for Florida's 1st congressional district had already been under investigation by the Justice Department for his involvement in sex trafficking and improper contacts with a minor. Gaetz denies the allegations, saying he has been the victim of an extortion scheme, lies, and leaks. He has not been charged with a crime. Gaetz is known as a high-profile supporter of former President Donald Trump. Turning to some coronavirus news now, Brazil has registered over 93,000 daily cases of COVID-19 as the South American country is grappling with a new surge of the pandemic. The health ministry said more than 3,700 people have died from the disease in 24 hours. Brazil has registered more than 13.3 million cases since the pandemic began, while the official death toll has surpassed 348,000. Brazil is the second worst hit nation by the virus in the world, after the United States, in terms of both fatalities and infections. India's hardest coronavirus hit state, Maharashtra, has entered a weekend lockdown as it battles surging infections and vaccine shortages. Under the measure, the state's 125 million people are allowed to leave their homes only for buying essentials. The restaurants are also shut down and public gatherings of more than 5 people are banned. Authorities say the lockdowns will continue throughout April. This comes as the state's capital, Mumbai, is facing vaccine shortage, causing the closure of several inoculation centers in the city. Maharashtra reported nearly 59,000 new coronavirus cases on Friday. The state accounts for 3.23 million cases out of India's overall 13.1 million infections. India is the world's worst hit country after the US and Brazil. Protesters in Algerian capital Algiers have chanted slogans against former colonial power France during a rally to demand political change in their country. The demonstrators slammed France for expressing support for President Abdelmadjid Tebboune. They carried placards reading, "Where France interferes, things get destroyed." Some protesters shouted, "France is back, young people get up." The latest demonstration is part of a protest movement called Hirak that helped force longtime President Abdelaziz Bouteflika to step down in 2019. The movement seeks the ouster of the whole ruling elite and change in the political system in place since the country's independence from France in 1962. After news broke of the death of the husband of British Queen, social media reacted quite differently to the news than the mainstream media. Insults, jokes and reminders of Prince Philip's racism were among the many online reactions. Our correspondent Robert Carter has more in this report from London.
A shock end to the week as British royal Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth II, was pronounced dead on Friday. Just hours after the news broke, mourners began gathering to lay flowers for the late Duke of Edinburgh, who was the longest-serving consort in British history.
Following the death of such a prominent member of the royal family, British media, particularly the BBC, appear to have gone into whitewash overdrive, portraying the prince as some kind of charitable war hero, whilst totally glossing over his various disgraces, including his numerous racist outbursts and his support for colonialism.
Both headlines and government statements were awash with complimentary tributes. But British social media reacted very differently, with Black and Irish Twitter hashtags going viral, two groups competing to mock the royals' scandal-ridden legacy.
His record is incredibly checkered. He has indulged in numerous racist outbursts and has indeed been a champion of British colonialism.
He said, for instance, back in 2002, a group of Indigenous Australians went on a visit to see them with the Queen. He asked them, "Do you still throw spears at each other?"
The British monarchy represents everything bad in their history, and so quite understandably, they have a different viewpoint on his death and what it means.
He said, "If you stay here much longer, you will all be slitty-eyed." That's what he told British exchange students who lived in Xi'an in 1986.
The prince had a bad habit of offending minorities, but also represented detested British imperialist values.
If we're going to swear an oath of allegiance to anybody, it should be an oath of allegiance to the people, that elect us. We're all living in a democracy. We shouldn't be swearing an oath of allegiance, it seems to me, to an unelected monarchy.
150,000 COVID dead, 10 years of austerity, 120,000 of the most vulnerable and poor people dead. That's who I shed a tear from.
For now, the flag at the palace has been lowered, and on Monday, Parliament will honour the Duke with further tributes. But no matter how hard the establishment ignore it, the British royal legacy is tarnished. Robert Carter, London.
The United States, France and Germany have called on Russia to halt a troop build-up on the borders with Ukraine and reaffirmed their support for Kiev in its confrontation with Moscow. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken held separate phone calls with his German and French counterparts where they discussed the increasing tensions between Kiev and Moscow. The NATO members described Russia's military build-up as a provocation and condemned what they called Russia's inflammatory and irresponsible rhetoric. Meanwhile, Moscow is accusing Kiev of taking provocative measures near its borders. Russia has pledged to defend its citizens in the flashpoint region depending on the scale of the military conflict there. Ukraine has also urged NATO to speed up the country's membership plan, heating up tensions with Russia.
Since Joe Biden took office in the U.S., relations between Washington and Moscow have only spiraled downwards. The Biden administration has signaled a more confrontational approach towards Russia. It has already hit Moscow with economic sanctions over the jailing of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Washington has also threatened unspecified action over an alleged massive cyber attack, which it blames on Russia. Tensions have risen particularly after Biden publicly stated that he thinks Putin is a killer. Now, the Russian government says it will respond in kind to any new U.S. sanctions amid reports that the White House is about to announce further bans against Russia. This time, the source of tensions is the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Over the past 2 weeks, mainstream Western media outlets have been reporting about an increase in Russia's military presence along its borders with Ukraine. This coincides with reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, leaving a ceasefire in the region effectively dead. Ukraine, the US and NATO accused Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in the region. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. Analysts believe Russia's military buildup along the border with Ukraine is a response to Kiev's saber-rattling.
This buildup of Russian troops is actually, to the contrary, it is in response to saber-rattling by Ukraine that is being instigated by the United States and in the form of NATO.
The notion that Russia is responding to Ukraine's escalation does not seem far from reality. Some observers believe Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is in a weak position at home, is playing the anti-Russian card to appease the nationalist population and mobilize support in the West. They cite a recent crackdown on pro-Russia media and figures, as well as Zelensky's public call on NATO to speed up Ukraine's membership plan. The Kremlin, which has repeatedly voiced concern over NATO's eastward expansion, bitterly opposes the notion that Ukraine could someday join the Western military alliance. After all, Biden has been one of Kiev's staunchest supporters since before the outbreak of the conflict in eastern Ukraine in 2014. This week, Biden himself pledged unwavering support to the Ukrainian government. It remains to be seen how far the new U.S. administration is ready to go in its confrontational path on Russia. If the current trajectory continues, soon we will see a full-scale war of sanctions between the two governments at the least.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust. From the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps. From the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, Thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in Thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in Thy kingdom. I beseech Thee to send blessings on Muhammad, Thy servant, Thy messenger. To let me ask Thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for Thy bounties, which alone get Thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey Thee and instinctively worship Thee, and make me deserve Thy rewards on account of Thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of Thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of Thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let Thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
The children of Palestine, whenever they join their elders in voicing protest against their tormentors, are singled out for the most brutal treatment that includes arrest, imprisonment, torture, and even death. It is rather unfortunate of the UN and international agencies to turn a blind eye to the persecution of the Palestinian children by the illegal Zionist entity. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kahan International. This article is published under the heading Palestinian Children Continue to Reel Under Israeli Regime Oppression. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Children are the future hope of every society and, in accordance with human nature, are shown utmost love, affection, and protection, not just by their parents and family elders, but also by the administration of the land where they live, with the laws emphasizing their proper grooming and education. Alas, the children of Palestine are deprived of this humanitarian privilege because their homeland is under occupation of the savage East European Zionists, who subject the sons of the soil, including minors, to all sorts of atrocities. In view of these brutalities, the UN had designated April 5th as Palestine Children's Day in order to focus on their plight and to make sure that their rights are observed even by the occupiers. The Israelis, however, are beasts. More properly, they're wolves in human clothing who have no sympathy for the Palestinian children, who continue to be treated in the most inhuman manner, on the slightest pretext. It is but natural of children. of every society or country to assist their elders and to protest the oppression to which their parents and kinsmen are subjected, including the destruction of homes and hearths and denial of all basic rights. The children of Palestine, whenever they join their elders in voicing protest against their tormentors, are singled out for the most brutal treatment that includes arrest, imprisonment, torture, and even death. It is rather unfortunate of the UN and international agencies to turn a blind eye to the persecution of the Palestinian children by the illegal Zionist entity called Israel. While marking Palestine Children's Day, the Palestine Prisoners Club revealed that there are 140 Palestinian children in the Zionist regime's jails. According to the Defense for Children International Palestine, every year between 500 and 700 Palestinian children are prosecuted by the Israeli regime in military courts. Until the end of March 2021, human rights groups have counted 230 Palestinian children detained by the Zionists, mostly in the occupied Islamic city of Beit al-Muqaddas, where the Zionist regime is carrying out intensive efforts to try to change the Arab Islamic identity of the sacred Al-Aqsa Mosque and the adjoining Palestinian quarters. It is now a common occurrence for the illegal migrants from around the world to harass young Palestinian children, beat them, kidnap them, and hand them over to the Zionists, armed forces in violation of international law. The irony is that the oil-rich Persian Gulf regimes, which have made a beeline for open diplomatic and other cordial ties with the occupiers of Islam's former Qibla, that is, direction of prayer, are the least concerned about the situation of oppressed Palestinian people, including the plight of the Palestinian children. The alarming situation warrants coordinated efforts by all conscientious people and human rights organizations around the world, especially of Muslim countries, to rally to the cause of the Palestinian children as an Islamic duty, since the notorious child killer regime of Benjamin Netanyahu is devoid of any human tendencies and is protected by the US, which itself is a major violator of the rights of children, as is evident by the inhuman treatment of the children of migrants from Latin American countries.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
who rules America.
Part 3.
When retired World War II General Dwight David Eisenhower ran for president, he was hailed as a military savior, an all-American hero from the plains of Kansas.
Now is the time for all good Americans to come to the aid of their country. Vote for Eisenhower.
No one expected that in his farewell address he would identify and oppose the emergence of a new power constellation, the military-industrial complex.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
His was a prophetic speech, especially for a military leader who saw that a fusion of government and corporate power could lead to what he called unwarranted influence and misplaced power. Fifty years later, on the warning's anniversary, President Eisenhower's own granddaughter, Susan, documented how the military-industrial complex had grown. She wrote, "In less than 10 years, our military and security expenditures have increased by 119%. This new book on the clout of the military-industrial complex by William Hartung details the power it wields. He told me how it works.
Military contractors, uniformed military, the Pentagon, basically pushing their interest at the expense of taxpayer, national security, in some cases our civil liberties.
Is it a description of an actual reality?
Well, the military-industrial complex is probably more real now than it was when Eisenhower coined the phrase. A company like Lockheed Martin, not only are they building missiles, they're building cluster bombs, they're building, submarines. At the same time, they're helping process your taxes, they're counting the census, they're running fingerprint databases for the FBI. So it's kind of morphed from just the military-industrial complex to sort of the national security state. So you've got surveillance as well as weapons building.
Hartung says these companies, in effect, dictate our foreign policy.
They've sort of captured our foreign policy and captured our military policy, really for special interest purposes to a large degree.
Writer David Swanson believes that this military-industrial complex relies on wars or the threat of wars to stay in business.
President Eisenhower pushed war propaganda in the very same speech and throughout his career, but he could not have been more right. I think he probably did not imagine how huge the problem of what he called the military-industrial complex would become. I describe it as a banker bailout every year. It is over a trillion dollars every year into the machinery of mass murder. It is over half of federal discretionary spending from the U.S. government. It is as much and more than all other nations of the world put into the military each year. It is much of it unaccountable. The Pentagon routinely loses quantities of money that are as much as most other governmental departments get.
It's not just that more money is being spent on arms, but the rise of the military-industrial complex has been accompanied by an overall rise in corporate power, and not just in the military sphere. Military contractors now have disproportionate influence, says Sheila Krumholz of the Center for Responsive Politics.
There is a huge sum of money coming from defense contractors in particular, and these range from AT&T and Boeing, the largest multinational kind of Goliaths. Their primary source of revenue may be telecommunications or transportation, but they have huge contracts worth a ton of money with the DOD and military. There have been a number of pieces of legislation aimed at both making that connection more transparent and trying to put a lid on the kind of pay-to-play method that has ruled, for instance, earmarks.
Have we seen a pattern of military and industrial collusion and industrial, you know, companies that do business with the Pentagon giving more and more money to politicians?
Many defense contractors were making contributions, spending lots of money to lobby, and in exchange, winning contracts that maybe they weren't the best organizations to benefit from. So there has been a lot of research done about how money greases the skids for defense contractors. I'll also say that the revolving door plays an important role. So it's not just money, it's other forms of elite influence, where people in the Department of Defense are kind of lining up their jump to the private industry, where they can rake in huge sums of money and lucrative posts in private industry that they used to regulate.
Alongside the military are huge intelligence agencies with vast budgets to spy, run covert action operations, collect personal data, and conceal how powerful interests operate. Secrecy is pervasive in a national security state, even as groups like WikiLeaks try to disseminate hidden information.
WikiLeaks, your baby, has, in the last few years, has released more classified documents than the rest of the world's media combined. Can that possibly be true?
Yeah, can it possibly be true? It's a worry, isn't it, that the rest of the world's media is doing such a bad job that a little group of activists is able to release more of that type of information than the rest of the world press combined.
Years earlier, an auto executive turned Defense Secretary Charles Wilson said what's good for General Motors is good for America. He saw no distinction between an elected government and an unelected corporation. GM was a car company that became a major defense supplier, buoyed by military spending, and then years later became a mortgage lender, driven by Wall Street-originated and often fraudulent subprime loans, until it nearly collapsed and had to be bailed out by government. The United States Supreme Court, in its Citizens United decision, has decided that corporations like GM have the rights of ordinary people and can openly and sometimes secretly lobby Congress and the public or finance political campaigns to promote their agendas. There are now many criticisms against Citizens United. Many of the arguments can be seen in this video by the Story of Stuff campaign.
We have a democracy in crisis. 85% of Americans feel that corporations have too much power in our democracy and people have too little. 85%! Hey, that's a majority. So let's get together and take our democracy back from the corporations. It's the first and most important step in making real progress on all the issues that people care most about.
There's also a counter campaign underway against corporate control of politics, focusing on two billionaire political donors, Charles and Edward Koch, two brothers, both industrialists, and both funders of conservative campaigns, including one to suppress voting by Democrats. Filmmaker Robert Greenwald has distributed this video nationwide.
Folks like the Koch brothers are attempting to ensure that as few people of color and as few young people show up as possible.
We've undergone a coup d'etat. We live in a corporate state.
Chris Hedges is a best-selling author and former reporter for the New York Times.
The people who rule America are the large corporate entities, which are supranational. They have no loyalty to the nation state. They are harvesting the country just like they're harvesting the rest of the globe. They're implanting a global neo-feudalism where workers around the planet have to be competitive, which means being competitive with sweatshop workers in Bangladesh who make 22 cents an hour or prison labor in China. It's a global neo-feudalism. It's one that is unassailable, completely untouchable, and more powerful than the host governments that were there nominally based.
Hedges is not alone in this view. Professor Michael Clare specializes in studying the country's largest industry, oil and gas.
I would say that the oil industry, or energy writ large, coal, natural gas, uranium, is the most powerful lobby in America, the most powerful economic interest, and it's tied to other powerful interests, automobile, highway construction, suburbia, many other industries, tourism, are all linked to energy, and they work together to keep America addicted to oil and to avoid the transition to alternative fuels.
Do they have an influence on our politics? Do they have an influence on what happens in Washington, what happens in the ballot boxes of America?
They're the biggest contributors to electoral campaigns in general, especially to the Republican Party, and I think they have a very powerful influence.
Do you think most Americans know how powerful they are?
Only the people who see this power in their daily lives have grasped the strength of it.
For many Americans, the military-industrial complex is seen only as a source of jobs. And in fact, military contractors win political support and federal funds by promising to create jobs.
There are real jobs, people working in the weapons factories and all the subsidiary subcontractors, but it's a fraud because you could take those same dollars and put it into any other industry, into infrastructure, green energy, education, or even into tax cuts for working people and produce more jobs than you do with the military spending. So it's worse than nothing, purely on the economic terms.
For years, there have been protests against America's wars and the military, but most have targeted politicians, not necessarily the corporations who profit from making weapons and other products for the military. One of the groups that's most visible in challenging militarism is a woman's group, Code Pink. Medea Benjamin is a co-founder.
I've learned that we don't rule America. I've learned that the Democrats don't rule America. The corporations rule America. I've been doing the work on the wars, and I've just been floored at how powerful these weapons manufacturers are and how powerful the contractors are, and that they have the ability to kind of keep wars going. I mean, that's pretty amazing when you think about it. Like, I'm just doing a lot of work around the drones issue. Do you know there's a drones caucus in Congress? I mean, instead of having a caucus to feed preschool children, you know, they decided it was more important to have a drone caucus, and that's because all the manufacturers in their districts are funding them.
They are quite open about it, and in fact, over 50 members of Congress have created a caucus for drones, a call where they openly promote the use and sale of drones at home and abroad, and then they've now authorized the flight of at least up to 30,000 drones in U.S. skies for whatever purpose. This is in contrast to the lack of any caucus for senior citizens, for children, for health coverage, for green energy, for human beings. There's a caucus for robots.
Eisenhower was so right, and he was so right when he said that it steals money. It robs us of food for our children, of health care for our parents. He was so right, and it's just worse and worse. And you get the little puppets in Congress, and I live in Washington now, so I see these little puppets and wish that they were like the NASCAR drivers that had to have their corporations on their suits. But they don't rule America. The corporations obviously rule America, and when it comes to war and peace, those corporations are so powerful that they've kept us for the last decade in war, and if we don't do something about it, they'll keep us in war for the next decade.
Beyond the debates about the role of the military, there may be a deeper challenge, because the United States has evolved from a nation into an empire with a far-flung system of bases, economic interests, and intertangled business dealings all around the world. Top political leaders interact with corporate leaders at meetings of elites, like the Bilderberg Conference, the Trilateral Commission, and the International Monetary Fund meetings. It's all part of a global structure of corporate culture, politics, and power. Some, like the billionaire George Soros, told me a while back that the World Economic Forum is more like a networking party than a decision-making venue. Decisions are often made behind the scenes, not at public events.
The Davos meeting is an enormous sort of cocktail party. A lot of contacts, people meet and so on. A lot of things are discussed. It's actually very convenient because you can meet a lot of people whom you want to meet in a confined period of time. And it's also a media event.
Is it also a symbol of the growth of sort of economic power, of over political power, a lack of sovereignty, a loss of sovereignty by some countries?
Well, it is actually symptomatic of the age, because you have presidents and prime ministers courting the financiers and the industrialists.
Only a few Americans seem to understand how corporatization and globalization go hand in hand. Walter Teague was one of the first activists against the Vietnam War. He believes that Americans can't see the facts because they're trapped in myths. I asked him how he would explain this situation to people on Mars.
I'd have to explain some very crazy things to them. I'd have to explain it in terms that they would perhaps understand. I'd have to not use some of the terms that Americans commonly use, because if you use the language that we're taught in school about democracy, free will, all of the, how the United States is number one, uber alles, right? All those terms lead the person to not being capable of understanding what you're saying, which is that there are really, and have been for a long time, a very small percentage, 1% or something like that, really make most of the decisions. But they are smart enough to make them in a way that keeps most Americans, until recently, from realizing that they're being ruled.
We cannot undo the plutocracy, the kleptocracy, the lack of representation without dismantling the military-industrial complex. This is the 1% of the 1%. This is where we give a banker bailout every year, and we don't get a dime of it back. We borrow it from China. We pay it back with interest. We keep interest rates ridiculously low. We crash Wall Street. We bail it out because we've created a war economy without any need for war.
Well, I think if people had a better sense of how these companies, how the uniformed military, how their allies in Congress are basically running the show, scaring us into spending on weapons we don't need, I think they'd have the beginnings of a tool to do something about it. But I think absent that information, there's sort of nowhere to start. There's nowhere to sort of plant your feet and try to fight back against it.
So I'd have to tell the Martians it's going to be very hard for you to understand why Americans don't see how they're being screwed. They don't see it, except when it gets so bad or so contradictory or so blatant or so personal, and then they wake up one day and say, oh, my God.
Does this mean in a way that business, that Wall Street, that defense contractors and others have disproportionate power? In other words, are they kind of one of the forces ruling our country that most people don't even know about?
I think that the money has great influence across the board, particularly where the issues are arcane and they seem disassociated with the average Americans, where constituents aren't paying attention and they're not being heard by their representatives in Washington. I think where people are paying attention, where it becomes there is a hue and cry from regular people, it's hard for the money to beat out the merits on policy. Politicians usually will not risk the political liability of being seen as catering to the interest bankrolling their campaign if the voters are paying attention. They're usually not that unwise.
Most of the public doesn't interface with the military-industrial complex because they participate in the economy as consumers. But even there, they're being affected by a power shift, an economic inequality that drives them deeper and deeper into debt. George Scribner is an executive with a corporation that advises other corporations. Today, it takes $200,000 a year to feel somewhat affluent. I asked George Scribner how he thinks growing inequality is affecting our politics. Who's in charge of our country? We keep reading more and more about big money in politics.
There was a great article of the 1% by the 1% for the 1%. And I think it might have been Vanity Fair, but I'm not positive right now. But they made a point that I've been making in terms of business, is that since World War II, it was headcount that made a difference. One person, one vote. So you play to the vote.
one person, $1. You played to as many people as you could to get the dollars. Now, because the assets are concentrated at the high end in the hands of the few, actually money is much more valuable, both to politicians and to marketers, than the mass of people that comprise the middle class.
So is the mass of people being left out now, the mass of Americans?
They aren't being left out, but they're certainly less important. So I think in a variety of ways, you'll see them being less catered to and manipulated more, in a sense, in politics and in terms of marketing, there'll be fewer products and fewer services.
That's one view from inside the corporate world, essentially saying that the majority of Americans have less economic power and, as a result, less political power.
People with money rule America because people with money can acquire power through that. But we all have... The great thing about America is we all live within the myth that each one of us can make a difference. And I think there are enough opportunities for that to happen that makes me think that the future won't be as bleak as it seems sometimes.
Even as President Eisenhower exposed the military-industrial complex, he also expressed a very American, deeply felt desire for peace and justice that history has largely forgotten.
From the earth. And that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love.
Coming up in the next episode of Who Rules America, the power of the media.
Ambassador, last thing.
So if you're looking at who rules America or who owns America, it's the same people that propagandize to America.
Next time on Who Rules America.
Limelight. Recently, a group of child rights experts have strongly criticized the UN Secretary General for excluding 8 parties, including the Israeli regime and the Saudi-led coalition, from a global blacklist of parties accountable for harming children during conflicts. Here we present you an article concerning this issue written by Alan Rock, who was Canada's ambassador to the UN from 2003 to 2006 and served as a UN special advisor on children and armed conflict in Sri Lanka, titled UN Should Stop Playing Politics with Children's Lives. The article was published by the Al Jazeera website. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Children around the world suffer the consequences of war. They're routinely killed, maimed, recruited to fight, and otherwise abused. In 2020, the United Nations reported more than 25,000 such grave violations in the previous year. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has powerful tools at his disposal to pressure those responsible to end such abuses, but he is failing to use them, often placing politics above children's lives. Over the past 20 years, the UN Security Council has put in place a framework to protect children in conflict zones. It requires the Secretary General to report every year on grave violations against children, including killing and maiming, recruiting child soldiers, sexual violence, and bombing schools. The Secretary General is required to attach a list of those responsible to his report. The list of shame, as it is sometimes called, is the linchpin for holding parties accountable for grave violations. When used as intended, the list has been a remarkably effective tool. Governments and non-state armed actors alike dread the stigma of being listed and are motivated to engage with the UN on steps they can take to end their abuses and be removed from the list. Alan Rock wrote, "I have seen for myself the power of the list. In 2006, I served as a UN Special Advisor on Children and Armed Conflict in Sri Lanka, where I met with dozens of heartbroken families whose children had been abducted by the Tamil Tigers or the government-linked Tamil Makal Pukal, that is TMVP, and forced to fight in Sri Lanka's civil war. The TMVP was added to the list of shame in 2006. Following intensive dialogue with the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, it signed and implemented an action plan to end the abductions, and it was removed from the list in 2011. Rock said, "At that time, there was a palpable sense of optimism among those of us working to protect children in armed conflicts. We saw the Secretary General's list as a strong instrument to root out practices like recruiting child soldiers. And for many years it was, in addition